time of deep division in today's society, we must come together for humanity's sake. On Can We Talk 360, we strive to stimulate an authentic conversation on issues that affect all of us in an environment of tolerance. I am Eugene Pettis, attorney and community servant. Tune into our discussion to foster a greater awareness of yourself and others. Let's discover how there is strength in our differences and an abundance of possibilities when we stand together as one humanity. Welcome to Can We Talk 360. I'm excited today to have a conversation with Jerry Gurley and Brooke Gurley, two individuals that you may have heard about. They've been in the news over the past few months regarding a case in which they Mr. Gurley tried in Orange County, Florida, up in Orlando. And he has gotten sanctioned by the Florida Bar, as has Ms. Brooke Gurley, for comments that he made and for retweets that she's made. And I want to have a conversation with them so they can tell their story about what it is that they do, the role of civil rights in today's society. Is it still necessary? Have we gotten to a point where everything's kosher? We don't have any further grievances on how people are being treated in our society. I want to hear from them and their experience to discuss that topic, as well as discuss the concerns, if any, that they have with the Florida Bar proposing sanctions against them for comments that they've made in the course of their post-litigation of a particular case. So welcome to Can We Talk 360 to both of you.
Thank you for having
Thank
me.
You. Thank you for having me.
First, I'll start with you, Mr. Gurley. Introduce yourself. I know you've been in Florida for what, 16, 17 years?
A little bit longer than that. I've been practicing law for 17 years, which the practice of law is not my first profession. I actually came to Florida in 1979. I was serving in the United States Navy. I met a girl, and I just never got out of Florida. And I'm married to that girl, and we've been married for actually 43 years. So when I first got out of the Navy, I worked for the Orlando Police Department as a civilian technician. And in that environment, looking at how law enforcement operated, I began to think in terms of maybe I would be better suited interpreting the law as opposed to enforcing the law. So I began a progression that ultimately led me to practice the law.
And you've been practicing law in Florida for how long?
Since 2007.
And among one of the areas you practice is civil rights. Do you practice any other area of law?
Yes, criminal defense. Those are not too distant in terms of how we encounter individuals who need our services. So yes, we do probably in terms of percentage, you know, we would say 75% civil rights, 25% criminal defense.
Okay. How about you, Mrs. Gurley, Brooke? Is it okay if I call you Brooke? And I want to be a little informal. Jerry and Brooke, is that okay?
Sure, absolutely.
That's fine with me. Yes.
Okay. Tell us about yourself, Brooke.
So I like to joke and say that I'm a runaway civil rights attorney. So I was born and raised in Florida, always wanted to be an attorney since watching Matlock on TV, just to age myself. And then I wanted to do civil rights because of my father, like very passionate about that. So I decided to be a civil rights attorney, went to law school, went, you know, straight through college law school, and just got very frustrated at the state of the law. I was like, oh, this is kind of this is insanity, you know, just seeing the state of things and how the courts have interpreted the life out of the statutes. So I decided I still wanted to do civil rights advocacy, but I decided to take an indirect route by going through media because I believe in the power of storytelling. So I've worked in media. I worked with Dan Abrams. We worked on a new network. I also worked in another Christian network and at a church. And then currently, I still do civil rights litigation, but it's been reduced mainly to writing, so responding to motions. But now I'm currently a professor, and so I teach legal writing as well as a civil rights course at Widener University.
And where is that university located?
In Delaware.
And one of the things you mentioned, Brooke, was that you had concerns about how basically the civil rights laws have been weakened. What were you referencing?
So it started actually my 2L year in law school, which second year, and I took an employment discrimination course. And I just saw how you have these Republican judges taking the statute that was meant to grant relief from discrimination, and how they were sort of making it increasingly difficult to prove your case, to even get out of a summary judgment motion. And so when I went to practice law, I saw that for myself, where you have these motions for summary judgment, where a lot of the plaintiffs are not even permitted to go to trial to bring their grievance to a jury of their peers. And I found that very frustrating. And I felt like part of the reason for that is because people don't have a full appreciation for the context and history of civil rights in this country. And so wanting to educate people through media, but then also sort of alert people to the state of things that, hey, you can, yes, we have a law, but if you go to try to litigate it, the chances of you getting to a jury are very slim. In fact, in a 2007 study said that I think like 70% of employment discrimination cases are thrown out at the summary judgment level. So I was frustrated by that.
Jerry, tell our audience, and I'll hear from both of you on this topic, civil rights. I mean, when you ask most people about civil rights, they think of Dr. Martin Luther King or that era. And tell me, when you're talking about civil rights, what does civil rights mean today? What does it encompass today?
Well, it encompasses this society's pledges, promises, covenant to people of color, particularly Black people, to ensure going forward that they will be able to stand on equal footing, not more, not less. Civil rights is somewhat similar to, but not exactly the same thing as civil liberties. When we talk about civil liberties, we're talking about your fundamental rights that are enshrined in the Constitution, the First Amendment, the Second Amendment, the Fourth Amendment. But when we talk about civil rights, now we're talking about a creature that is connected to the Constitution, but not directly flowing from. For example, the Civil Rights Act of 1964 was passed under as one of the enabling statutes, believe it or not, from the Commerce Clause. We would think, typically, if you know the Constitution, that it somehow related to the 14th Amendment, but actually it was premised upon the Commerce Clause. So, but the rights are there to protect certain individuals who historically have been disadvantaged and quite candidly discriminated against because of some immutable quality, race, gender, national origin, faith, which is not necessarily an immutable quality, but these protected categories. So when we talk about civil rights, we're talking about the government's efforts to provide the protection to people who are at risk for being disadvantaged and discriminated against in society. Now, one thing that I want to add quickly is that, I'm sure we'll get into this further, when you talk about civil rights and you talk about Dr. King, you talk about Thurgood Marshall, what we need to understand there is that the first Civil Rights Act that was passed in this country was 1866.
Very few people know that.
So then there's a Civil Rights Act of 1875, and then there's the Civil Rights Cases of 1883, which I think Brooke may want to talk about because she's the professor, where essentially what happens is this country begins to back away from its commitments. And then we find in that case the tragic language, which says something, and I may be not quoting it exactly, but the sentiment I think you'll get, that there comes a time when people who have been previously hobbled by the condition of slavery must cease to be the special favorites of the government and stand on their own two feet. And the sentiment that the Supreme Court was articulating was that the show is up, we are post-racial, and now you have to stand on your own. We've resolved our issue of race, and you guys are you guys, meaning black people, are not going to get special treatment. Now, the question is, what was the court correct in saying that and arriving at that conclusion that we were post-racial? Even in saying that we...
Give us that time period.
That time period would be 1883, 1875, 1866, on up to 1883, because there is a series of cases that led to that court decision, that Supreme Court decision. And the much larger point that I'm making, sir, is this, that we think about the issue of race in linear terms. But I think if we study out history, not just in the United States, but around the globe, there are certain things that are cyclical in nature. So we have been down this road before. We've covered this territory, and we're not going in a line. We're going in a big circle. At least that's this lawyer's assessment.
Yeah.
Ms. Brooke, give me your perspective. I mean, you come from a... Obviously, you're Mr. Gurley's daughter, and you come from another generation. I'll be interested in your take on civil rights. When we're talking about civil rights, your father just talked about its origins, if you will, back into the 1800s. And most people don't know about those civil rights acts that were in place, fought against by those that did not want any change a couple of times. And from there, we went into the Reconstruction era, and then we went to Jim Crow. That took us way back in a different direction. So there's been a recoiling effect, if you will, in our civil rights battles here in this country. From your perspective, when we're talking about civil rights, what are we discussing?
So just to echo kind of what my dad was saying, I teach a class here called The Untold Stories of the Civil Rights Movement. And the first class, what I have them do is break down, how do you define the civil rights movement? Is it just We Shall Overcome and Dr. King? And then there was an article by someone named Jacqueline Hall, and she argues that there's a long civil rights history. So it's kind of like, where do we actually start this? I started the civil rights movement in the Dred Scott case, where the court said that black man has no rights, which the white man is bound to respect. And that's from 1857. And there you had a black man and his wife fighting for their freedom, for the liberation. And I think civil rights is rooted in the struggle for black freedom and liberation. And then you get into the Reconstruction period after slavery, with the 1866 Act, which is still good law, and the 1875 law. And what you see going on there is you really see the first happenings or first phase of a civil rights movement in this country, because the civil rights cases of 1883 were actually a group of cases, and some people were organized and they were trying to get trying to enforce the Civil Rights Act of 1875. So that's part of it. But you really see a lot of movement with the Plessy versus Ferguson case in 1896. And there, everyone knows that's the case that started Separate but Equal, which Brown overturned. But going on there, that case was actually a test case. Homer Plessy went into the train car and said, listen, I know I'm black and I shouldn't be up here. Arrest me. And they were trying to test it. And it was a very organized group of people, not unlike what you saw in the 1950s and 60s, but of course, with very different outcomes. After they lost, here comes Jim Crow. And what you also see in these cases of Plessy, as well as 1883 cases, civil rights cases, is similar language. You have the courts trying to start this notion of colorblindness, saying that if black people think being separated makes them inferior, that's something that they're putting on that has nothing to do with us. You have the language that my dad just echoed that said, you need to pull yourself up by your bootstraps and stop being a special favorite. You see a lot of the themes that we from today, such as, again, colorblindness, black people, it's something that you're put on. It's the same thing today when you have like the affirmative action cases. So like my father said, what I think of civil rights, I see this big cycle of repeated phrases. Like, you could take some of the language out of the 1883 case in Plessy versus Ferguson and tell them to people today, and they would think that it was from today. But it's just remarkable, because in 1883, you had people, we're only what, that was like 18 years out of slavery, and you're telling the slaves, get over it, we're post-racial. And so if America in 1883 was not willing to deal with the issue of race and racial discrimination, I don't have much hope that they're really willing, that they have the heart for it, but hopefully they'll see, listen, again, this is what I said before. If people understood the history, that these arguments are not new, but they are rooted in years of history, of American history, then we wouldn't address them and look at them the same way. If we know that these same arguments led to Jim Crow, then we actually have to take them seriously today, because we don't know what they could lead to for tomorrow. So that's what I see civil rights as, this unending cycle of oppression and fighting oppression and then trying to sustain justice.
You know, the get over it part, you know, I've been on boards over my 38 years. And one of the toughest but heartfelt conversations that I've had is getting good people, non-African-American folks, to understand that it's not possible when you've been held back so long to just say, okay, now compete. And I gave an example on a board, South Florida Water Management District, back in the 90s. When they were, it was a Croson decision, set asides, and all of that discussion was going on. And I said that there is no way women and minorities can compete if there's not some consideration that they've been suppressed from the game for decades and decades and decades. And all of those public bidding have a percentage based on experience. Well, if you've not given me the chance to get experience, I'm going to lose that deal every time. Right. So I said, it's like having a marathon that, you know, the white guys who've been in the game forever had the best training, the best trainer, the best equipment, the best shoes, did it for a whole year of training. And 2 weeks before the marathon, you realize you didn't have any diversity and you threw me in. Is there any chance that I'm going to compete? The answer is no, because I haven't had the chance to compete. So what do you say to people that, you know, everybody's aware, most people's knowledge starts in 64 Federal Civil Rights Act. Back up 1 second. We also have a Civil Rights Act in the state of Florida. Is that correct?
Yeah, chapter 760 in the Florida statute.
760, and I think that's from around 1992. I think it's the act of 1992. How does the federal and the state compare in a brief discussion?
So I speak to that. So essentially they're the same, meaning if you look at the case law that constructs chapter 760, there's statements right in there that says we look to the case law that constructs Title VII to construct Chapter 760. So when I'm arguing in state court about why summary judgment is not appropriate, I'm often citing to 11th Circuit cases, unless I can find a 5th DCA case or a 6th DCA case that's more favorable. Because, of course, the federal statutes and the federal case law sets the floor, but not the ceiling. So now, yeah, but here, as a practical matter, we find that we do have greater success in state court. The same types of remedies are available because, again, Chapter 760 is patterned after Title VII. So there's compensation for emotional pain and suffering. There's reasonable attorney's fees and lost wages, back wages. There is all of the same relief. What's more favorable is the potential jury pool. And up until, I guess it was 2021, the summary judgment rule was entirely different. But now, and I think, Gene, you're aware of that, the rule has been synchronized with Rule 56. And so there have been more summary judgments in state court, but still the judges tend to be more willing to let these matters be resolved by juries in state court. I would agree with what Brooke said earlier in terms of the 70% summary judgment rate on employment cases, but I would narrow that statement and say in federal court. That's the statistic, okay? And I will tell you, Gene, in my experience in terms of filing employment discrimination cases in the Middle District, in the Southern District, and maybe one or two in the Northern District, don't quote me on that exactly. I probably filed in this last 17 years, maybe 40 employment discrimination cases. I've only made it through the trial three times. Conversely, I've filed hundreds of employment discrimination cases in state court. I always make it to the trial and or the case is settled. The summary judgment rate is 25%, if that.
And the Civil Rights Act 760 in Florida that you were speaking of, I just want to give the audience some context. It's designed to secure for all individuals within the state freedom from discrimination because of race, color, religion, sex, pregnancy, national origin, age, handicap, or marital status, and thereby to protect their interests and personal dignity. And it goes on. So that gives you a context. It's just not race, but it's a number of people and persons and categories that are captured within the civil rights, both on the federal level as well as on the our state level. You mentioned the challenges on the federal level and compare it to the state. And you reference our jury pool decisions, and the state court get to the jury a lot more than in federal court, which dismisses more of these cases. What has been your experience in getting, as we have always been told, we're entitled by law to get a jury of our peers to hear our cases? What's been your experience in the civil rights arena in that regard?
Well, in state court, when we get to trial, the biggest challenge that we face, quite candidly, and I've gotten pushback, but I'm now talking about my experiences, is that we have a fairly representative venari panel, meaning those who come to serve. Let's say we're trying to narrow down to six jurors and one alternate. So we may start out with 40. And typically in Orange County, where I try most of my cases, those venari panels that walk through the door are pretty representative. But the challenge has been that some of my opponents on the other side seem to target and to use their peremptories and to, in some cases, to urge the judge to strike for cause or for hardship people of color. And it's been a pattern. It's been my experience, and I want to stress that. It's been my experience. And if I told you all the cases and I gave you the case numbers and you and actually looked at the transcripts, you will see how many times I've made the Batson challenge or the Slappy challenge or the Melbourne challenge.
Folks, what those challenges are.
Okay. So as you're talking about, we have a Sixth Amendment to right to have a jury of our peers. That is both a right of the person, the party to the litigation, but it's also a right that a person who presents himself or herself to serve on the jury has. It's a Sixth Amendment right. So when a person is challenged in terms of being able to serve on the jury, and that person is being challenged potentially for racial reasons, then the law provides a mechanism called the Batson challenge, where you bring that to the attention of the court and you ask the challenging party to give a racially neutral reason for trying to get this person off the jury. So what I'm telling you, Gene, is that that has been so frequent that, you know, part of my trial prep is to make sure my cases that deal with that issue are up to date, knowing full well that we're going to spend 2 or 3 hours dealing with that issue all by itself. So it's the first barrier or the first hurdle that I experience when I'm actually in the trial posture.
And when you contest, speaking of your experience, when you contest on Batson or Slappy or any other authority. What have you seen in your 17 years in these civil rights cases? The objection that you raised, how frequently are you able to hold somebody on the jury as someone not having a legitimate reason for striking them?
I would say 10 to 20% of the time I'm able to defeat the strike, the peremptory strike, or to convince the judge that this person should not be removed for cause. So what I'm saying then to Eugene is that the majority of the time when a person of color is challenged, that person is knocked off the jury, period. That's in my experience, I'll say that.
You know, one of the things that I've had this conversation many times is that challenging either Batson or Slappy, saying that the jury needs to reflect our community, it's not an insult to our white brothers or sisters that they cannot serve with dignity and honesty. But the room, the jury room, is more dynamic when you get perspectives from the whole community. And I think history has proven that in many, many, many cases when the room has been all white men. As we go back in time, that's all the juries were made up of. And no matter what the case was, you knew the decision before it was, you know, closing arguments were over. So it's not, from my perspective, a reflection on, well, they can't be fair. It's the promise is to be a jury of peers, racial, economic, whatever you want to define as peers. It needs to be a diverse group to hear the case. Because, and I talk about this even on the bench, you know, when I was bar president pushing for diverse benches. I have a lot of white judge friends, and they're great people, and they're honest people. But the experience of being a good judge doesn't stop when you become a good judge, when you become on the bench. It just starts, because everybody has walked a certain path in life. And if I've never walked on the east side, and I was on the south side, I'm not going to have any perspective of that experience. But if I'm in the room with someone who walked on the east side, I can learn and be gain different perspective. So I want to say that because the context of which you're wanting a jury that's reflective of all is, I take it, is in that same vein, that same purpose.
Absolutely. And on top of that, of course, and I'm sure you're aware, there are many studies that establish that, and this is not about prejudice or racism or race per se. It's about people being able to relate. You know, for example, I've had some civil rights cases where my client was running from the police, and the question was asked, well, why would a black man run from the police if he hasn't done anything wrong? Well, if you have lived in certain communities, the answer to that question is already known. But if you haven't, that doesn't make you prejudiced, but that makes you perhaps unaware of all the factors that go into the decision that is made there in that moment. You know, one of the studies that I did, I was aware of as a part of my senior writing paper in law school, or my 3L final paper, was a study that was done. And it involved three counties here in the state of Florida. And what that particular study, I believe it was a Duke study. I believe that it was a study that was done in 2002. So again, I'm going from memory. But what it showed was the likelihood, and it was looking at criminal outcomes and the likelihood of a conviction based upon who was serving on the jury. And it showed that if you had a black, particularly a black male defendant, and you had a mostly white male jury, the possibility of conviction was way up. But then if you introduce just one black person into the jury pool, then the percentages change drastically. And again, this is not about prejudice or racism or bigotry. I think it's about people being able to identify. And so having diverse voices in that jury room is critical. And I'm going to always be a strong advocate for that. And certainly in every case that I try, I'm going to stand there and fight for that for my client.
Hey, Brooke, from your perspective, do you have any comments on that topic?
On jury selection? I mean, I've also litigated with my father on a few cases, and I would say all but one case did I see them try to strike every single Black person from the panel. And it was consistent, and you could see they were doing on-the-cuff type of explanations. But because of the rule, the way that it's set up in Batson, it's almost you just have to give any kind of explanation. And this is something that Thurgood Marshall, in his dissent or concurring opinion, sort of expressed concerns about. He's like, you know, they can give you a reason, but you don't know what we now call implicit bias. He said subconscious racism could be at play. And so I see sometimes it's blatant, maybe blatant racism. But I echo the concerns of Thurgood Marshall with like this. I have an issue with how we do jury selection. And the fact that, again, going to this historical lens, the issue of excluding Black people from the jury is dated back to the first case that dealt with this, Estrada versus West Virginia in 1880. And we just keep seeing it come up, including to 2019 with Curtis Flower, where this man, Black man, was tried six times for the same crime. And each time it was overturned, and half of those times was because the prosecutor struck all the Black people. And so the Supreme Court had to come back and say, don't do it. So I echo the concerns. It's very disheartening because the jury box is such an important box in society, is voting box and the jury box. And if you're excluding people who have a particular perspective, again, it's not about race all the time. It's about I'm bringing a cultural perspective that maybe you don't understand and trying to explain things that you would otherwise find suspicious. When that perspective is gone, then you wonder, is it truly a just system? Is it truly a jury of your peers at the end of the day?
And it's interesting. Before we went on the air, I was raising about the Florida Supreme Court's study back in 1990. They studied from 89 to 90, came out with a report in 1990, and a second report in 91. And it was Judge Ehrlich who was the chief judge at that point in time back in 1990. And they looked, among other things, at jury selection. You know, and so it's not that y'all are coming out of, you know, an unproven area of concern. It's been recognized, as Jerry, you indicated, by multiple studies, and also by our own Florida Supreme Court that talked about jury selection and the importance of unbiased juries in our process. You look at sentencing. You know, there are a lot of studies out there, and you know this better than I. You mentioned something, Jerry, early, that civil rights and criminal defense is not that far apart. What did you mean by that?
Well, the first civil rights case that I got in terms of the Curley Law Firm was a client of mine who was facing a jail sentence that we had some concerns about, but in that setting, in that context, he was facing the possibility, if he was confined for a certain period of time, he was going to lose his job. And so he asked for some help there. And as an compliment to what I was doing, I agreed. And then as I began to explore that, I saw that a lot of people who were facing criminal charges, some legitimately, some not legitimately, are also having other issues in their life. And a lot of those relate to civil rights, what we would talk about broadly as civil rights. So that's the connection. But also the community that typically I'm dealing with is going to, a lot of the people that I'm dealing with on civil rights, even though I have to say the Gurley Law Firm represents people who are literally sanitation operators who drive the trucks and pick up your garbage on the side of the road. And on the high end, we represent brain surgeons. We stand for what is right, and we, if someone's rights have been violated, we stand for them. But there is a certain profile of the average client that we see, and some of those people from that community are impacted adversely by the criminal justice system as well.
A main theme in the complaint that was brought against both of you is disparaging comments toward the judiciary, to the court system. And I'm not going to go into all the details of what those comments were, but some of them were your experiences. And how do you jibe, if you will, what you know as fact from your experience, such as what we were just talking about, how white attorneys, people who are defending companies, et cetera, that are defending against civil rights claims, get rid of people of color if the plaintiff is an African descent person. That's fact. What do you say to somebody who's saying, well, you're disparaging the institution?
No, I'm actually pointing out what the studies show, first of all. If we remove Jerry Gurley from the equation altogether, the studies show that. But then I'm certainly talking about my experience, and all I can do is be honest in terms of my experience. But my intent is never to demean or to do harm to the justice structure, because that's the only structure we have. My hope is always to improve. And, you know, I should tell you this, Gene, also, because I'm 63 years old. And so practicing law is like the third thing that I did in life. But for 20 plus years before I was an attorney, I was a minister, pastor. And one of my pastor friends used to always say, in order to get people saved, and that's a term that we use in terms of getting people into the church and getting them on the morally right path, we have to first convince them that they're lost. So people aren't going to address a problem that they don't know exists, or that they are not in agreement with you exists. And the only way that we address any problem and correct any problem is by talking about it and confronting it head on. And so that's all I know to do. And when I talked about things that concern me regarding the court system here in Florida, it wasn't with the intent of saying, can we do better? We certainly need to do better.
You know, one of the issues that I feel strongly about is the importance of diversity of our judiciary. And it's not just me. I mean, it goes back, as I said, the Supreme Court addressed it in 1990. And again, there's many studies about this across the country. I fought for that when I was bar president, because it's important for a multitude of reasons. You're not entitled to have a lawyer from your neighborhood or from your race or anything else, but it's good to have somebody in the courthouse that looks like you. It gives a level of comfort that you know you're not in this system alone. And you made a comment. One of the comments you made was about the 5th DCA being all white. What did you mean about that?
I meant, and I was referencing some of the studies that I saw that were done by the Supreme Court. And even, I believe, the study that was done when you were the president, which stressed the importance of having diversity in the judiciary. And also, indirectly, if not directly, at points talked about implicit bias. So again, all perspectives need to be brought to all levels of the court system. Okay, we're talking about the prosecutors. I have friends who are people of color who are prosecutors. I think that's great. I have friends, going back to the 80s when I worked at the Orlando Police Department, who are police officers. And high-ranking police officers. I think that's wonderful. I think we need Black public defenders. We need Black and Latino and Asian and just global representation at all levels of the court system. Certainly the people who actually do the administrative work. And most, I think significantly when we talk about the judges, the trial judges and the appellate court judges, and certainly even the Supreme Court. Everyone wins, no one loses when we have a diverse perspective. And conversely, I would say we are all in danger when there's just one perspective or a majority perspective that's brought to the majority of the conversations.
And that's race, and in my opinion, gender as well.
Absolutely.
You put together a room of men to make decisions, as so often is happening now in these times, about what ladies should do with their bodies, etc. Many times the women are not a part of that conversation. And how could we as men, males, decide those issues without a female perspective being in the conversation? Brooke, what do you say about that?
Oh, no, absolutely. I think it was one of the, I don't know if it's legislators, someone who didn't even, they had something online, didn't even understand how feminine products worked or how you use them. And like, but you're making decisions about what women are supposed to do. I just echo everything that you all are saying, is that it's so important to have that additional perspective. And to say that does not mean that you're calling someone racist, prejudiced, but it's saying that we live in a diverse society, and our court system, like you said, all the way up from the judges, jurors, anyone should reflect what our society looks like. And if it's not reflecting that, then we have to take affirmative steps to actually correct that issue and not be so like, oh, no, this is you're calling people racist. That's kind of like an easy smokescreen to stop that progress. But we still have to push forward. Otherwise, we're not living up to our own standards as a country.
You know, Florida is unique in that it's one of the most diverse states in the nation. I've had conversations, well, we don't have anybody applying. Well, it's not because they don't want to be on the JNCs. It's because they've tried so many times and been denied until people get defeated. I had to go out and encourage people, don't be defeated, put your name in. And we diversified the JNCs significantly for the better of our community. And that's what we have to come to as a society. Don't be scared of inclusion. You know, now in the state of Florida, you know, you, in certain educational institutions, you can't even use those words, DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion, which I find to be absolutely ludicrous. But that's for another day. But there's nothing to be scared of about inclusion. We're all better as a result of it. And when you made the comment about the fact that the 5th DC was all white, that is in fact a fact. It's not, you can't deny it. You are not saying they're racist or they're not able to do their jobs, but that having a broader perspective is what you were referencing.
Right. Yeah. I mean, like you said, well, I'll defer to Brooke. Go ahead, Brooke. You look like you were.
No, I'll let you get that. When you were talking, Gene, what it made me think about is when you say don't be afraid of inclusion and diversity, I think what's at stake is that there's this sense that by including you or opening up the door, then I'm going to be, for those who are currently in privilege, that I'm going to lose something. So there's this tension that if I give it to you, then I'm going to lose something. That's not fair to me. Again, this is language that you see back when President Jackson was, when he vetoed the Civil Rights Act of 1866, he was saying that you're giving special rights to Black people that white people don't even have. And so there's this kind of tension. The fear is that if I give it to you, then I'll lose something and that's wrong, instead of maybe considering I have something that I should not have fairly. And I need to sort of exchange things, that why do I have this privilege that other people don't have? And why can't I extend it to people? But people don't see that. It's a cost, a loss benefit, a cost benefit analysis that people go through. And I think that's also at play, is that to give you what you're asking for means that I have to become a loser, instead of thinking we can all be winners.
And the proof is in the pudding on that, Brooke, because I've seen a lot of occasions, the exact fear that you just referenced. If I let somebody else in the circle, I get less. The truth is the pie gets larger. When the pie gets larger, your percentage may be less, but you take as much, if not more, because the whole process becomes more rich and enriched with diverse minds and people. And it's been proven many times. Jerry, you were going to say something, that I have another topic I want to discuss with you.
No, I was just going to say, and I think you both have hit it well, is that there's a false tension there. That's what that is. That's a contrived tension between equity and exclusion. I mean, equity is the enemy or the opponent of exclusion, but it's not the enemy of the people. Everyone benefits when all have a role and a part, and all are invested who feel that they will benefit from their efforts, whatever those efforts are. And so that tension is what, that false tension, which I would say historically has never completely gone away, is what causes us to have these periodic resurgences, such as what we're experiencing today.
The before we switch to another topic, I wanted to inquire. As a civil rights lawyer, everything you do is challenging a system of our society, advocating that it's not fair to whoever you're representing. You don't go into court and say, file a lawsuit and say, everything's well, and I just wanted to file a lawsuit to let you know that. You're challenging a system in civil rights. Is that what you do?
Right. I mean, and that system is not just what happens in the court. It's society, right? I mean, it's everything that is going on in society. And yes, what I often say to people when they walk through my doors is, I only see people when something has gone wrong. You know, if it's fair, I tell people this, if it's fair, then I don't have a job. If we reach, and I would like to be on one level philosophically in a place where a person like me and the profession, the narrow aspect of the law that I practice is no longer necessary, but we're not living in that day. And I often use this metaphor, Gene, if I can. If we think about the past that we came from as a nation, the racism, clearly the bigotry and all of that, we think of that as some type of social political malignancy. We have made great strides. And I'm not here disputing that we've not made great progress in terms of reversing that and doing better toward about treating all people equally. But if we start out with a malignancy and we substantially reduce that malignancy from 5 centimeters to 0.3 centimeters, and then we walk away and we do no further treatment, guess what's going to happen? Yeah. That malignancy is going to resurge with a vengeance. And so that is the basic dynamic that we keep not understanding, that we do the work and it's not real. It's not imagined. It's real. The progress is real, but it's not complete. You know, we have to complete the work.
Well stated. Well stated. You both of you have been, it's been a recommendation of suspension to your licenses for the case that you're before the bar on. And I indicated that I didn't want to get into all the dynamics of that case. I'm going to let you all play that out in the proper forum. But what, if any, concern do you all have for you doing what you did in the case that you represented the Black doctor, and you're being sanctioned now, a recommendation of 30 days suspension? What impact does that have on you, and what impact does that have on other people that do what you do?
Mm-hmm. So, Gene, let's talk about the broad concern that I have for civil rights lawyers, particularly lawyers of color. First, on its best day, if there are no artificial, or what I perceive to be artificial, barriers, it's difficult work. I said that. And in fact, what I said, one of the comments that some have taken issue with, is that I said it's like putting a 100-pound boulder on your back and climbing up a mountain while people are rolling boulders down at you as you climb. That's just how Jerry Gurley feels when I walk into court, when I'm looking at a 70% dismissal rate of employment discrimination cases in federal court. And now I'm looking at a summary judgment rule that has been synchronized with Rule 56 in state court. But I have to continue to climb. I have no option. But I'm concerned that the younger generation, the people who don't share my perspective, will say it's not worth it. I mean, I can make a living and be comfortable in my space and have status and all of those things and not have to deal with that headache. Some people have approached me and said, I bet you really enjoy being a civil rights lawyer. I mean, I bet you. And I tell them, and to their surprise, I'd rather not be a civil rights lawyer. I'd rather that this job, that this malignancy, that this lack of inclusion, that this lack of equity that we as a nation have grappled with historically and done better at times than other times. I would rather see this work done, but it's not done. So I'm thinking about my mom, who's from a place called Pine Bluff, Arkansas, and my dad. I'm talking about slaves. I'm talking about my mom, who picked cotton for 10 hours a day for $3 a day, and my father, who picked cotton who were sharecroppers. So I feel very fortunate to sit here in this suit and tie and call myself an attorney, but I cannot therefore think only about myself, because they didn't think, the people who came before us, the Dr. King, the Thurgood Marshalls, if they only thought about what was personally convenient for them, would any of us be sitting here doing what we're doing? I don't think so. So I'm driven and I'm guided by that. But I don't know that everyone would be thinking like I think. And I think quite candidly, this kind of response from the Florida Bar would have a chilling effect on most people who would otherwise be inclined to take up this burden or this cause, knowing separate and apart from all that, it's going to be challenging. No, it's just too much. So I'm very, very concerned about that. And in fact, I've had private conversations with people who said, well, stay on the battlefield because I'm not the one. And I understand that quite candidly. So yes, that's a long answer, but this is where I'm coming from. My heart is in it and I'm not doing it for the money. And the work is simply not done, but it's going to mean that less people are willing to do the work. I think that's my concern.
Do it. When less people are willing to do it, what's the consequence?
Well, then the law doesn't exist for all practical purposes, right? I mean, if you don't have someone who's willing to take these cases, then the law doesn't exist. And then you have women getting discriminated against. You have minorities. You have just a proliferation. There's no checks and balances. The law is there to set the floor in terms of our minimum expectations, in terms of how we're going to conduct ourselves as citizens in this great nation. But if the law doesn't exist, and even though it's on, see, the law can exist on paper, right? But it doesn't exist if you can't consistently enforce it in the courts of law. So I think that's the danger, that the law simply goes away as a practical matter and people suffer needlessly. That's the concern that I have.
Brooke, from your generation, what's your concern
about this case? I mean, a couple of things. The reason why I'm even fighting this case, because they initially offered me diversion, which I don't know how you go from diversion to a 30-day suspension, but I decided not to take it because I felt like, one, obviously I didn't do anything wrong, but I'm thinking broader than myself. If you can silence me, because the comments that I made, like you said, was a retweet. The other things were me giving my opinion, like the Dred Scott rule still applies. So I'm giving historical commentary and just answering people's questions on social media. And so if the bar can reach into social media accounts and attack the speech there, then where does that end? I can't let that sit as precedent. So that's because otherwise, again, because it's hard to be a civil rights attorney. And I think an important part of being a civil rights attorney is the educational piece as well. So yes, we go into court and we fight, but we also educate the community, and we can do that in various forms. And if the bar doesn't like it and they want to come after us as we're just educating people, then again, I'm afraid that it will have a chilling effect, not just on whether or not we litigate cases, but even how we educate the community to let people know what's going on. So my major concern is that in a public forum, which social media is effectively, the bar being able to come in and sort of regulate the speech there, because this is content-based discrimination. Because if I said the judge did everything wonderful, they wouldn't have come for me. But because they didn't like some of the retweets, again, not even my words, but some of the things that I said using history to back up what I was saying, now they're coming for me. So I'm concerned about that. And then also I'm co-author an article too about just the disparity in disciplinary process with bars in general and how minority attorneys are disproportionately impacted by that. So because I know that that is part of the history and that's part of the data that's currently out there, like California did a study in 2019 that showed that Black men were more likely to be disbarred. Because of that, again, I knew I had to fight this because I can't let that stand as precedent. Black people, and then of course, attorneys who are fighting for civil rights. So those are kind of my general concerns here.
Yeah. Well, I want to say also is, look, you can't do this work if you are concerned about yourself personally and comfort and convenience and status. Look, they will kill you today. And I'm speaking metaphorically, guys. I want to make sure that's clear.
Or literally.
And they will build a monument to you tomorrow. That's human behavior throughout time. So you can't ask them to build a monument to you today and not be willing to stand in front of, metaphorically again, the water hoses and the angry dogs. And I'm not just talking about court system, because I get a lot of pushback in all areas, not just things that have happened to me. But the difference between this 30-day proposed suspension, which may go through, and what Thurgood Marshall had to deal with, 75 years ago, was not only was he facing hostilities or disfavor within the court system, but when he literally left out of the building to get into his car, he had to get out of town because he was in mortal danger. I'm not in mortal danger. I mean, I don't think I deserve to be suspended for 30 days. And I agree, if I'm having a constitutional conversation, that this is content motivated or content restriction. And the Supreme Court has spoken time and again about, when you're talking about something that is strictly speech and it's about content, now we're crossing into First Amendment considerations. But I'm not obsessed with that. So if it is 30 days for me, at the end of the day, it's 30 days for me. But hopefully it's a better opportunity for people who come after me.
And I also wanted to just add one thing. When they were recommending the 30 days, they said this would be to protect the public. Yet when I talk to others within the African-American community, they feel like this is a front. So the question is, well, which public are you trying to protect by suspending us for 30 days? Who is exactly your intended public that you want to keep safe? Because the people that we represent in these civil rights cases do not feel like this actually protects anything. So that's also, again, another reason why this isn't just about us, but it's broader than my dad and myself.
Well, I could speak to you all for another hour. I really appreciate your time and your insight. And I thought it was a conversation that needed to be had. It's still an issue that we have to deal with in this society. And the day that we think that everything's perfectly fine, that's just not reality. And I've been doing this for 38 years. I've represented employees and employers. I know the challenge is there. And until we feel it's okay for people in general and lawyers in particular who are advocates for a better society, can speak of the deficits that we have in our justice system, Imagine if we're silenced as lawyers and advocates from talking about how we can better make our justice system. And that's as broad as from the law enforcement to the courts to all the ancillary spaces around the justice system. If that's ever silenced, we will not be the great nation that we hold ourselves to be. It's critical that we recognize the importance of being challenged, because just as in life, when you're challenged, typically you come out better. And I commend you all for the work that you all have done. Wish you Godspeed. And again, thank you very much for coming on to Can We Talk 360 to open up this conversation that I think needs to be held at a broader level so people can understand why we still need civil rights lawyers and what it means to be a civil rights lawyer. And the challenges are not an affront. Every challenge is not calling someone a racist. It's just saying that it's a wrong and that we need to do better. So I think y'all have articulated that very well. Thank you for your time. And till next time, thanks for tuning in to Can We Talk 360.
The law firm of Halitzer Pettis & Schwamm is a proud sponsor of the Can We Talk 360 podcast. Our firm handles medical malpractice, wrongful death, catastrophic personal injury litigation. We pride ourselves in being advocates for justice on behalf of those who have been seriously injured. For decades, we've taken the lead in making your case our priority. It's who we are. It's who we'll always be. Halitzer Pettis & Schwamm. Serious injuries. Proven results.
Thank you for listening to today's episode of Can We Talk 360. I sincerely hope that you were inspired to seize this moment in time and take real action towards change. Remember, all change begins with a conversation. Be sure to tune in every month for more fascinating discussions and motivational food for the soul. Please share with your friends, family, and colleagues. Follow me on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube at Can We Talk 360. And visit us on the web at www.canwetalk360.com.